Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Beth Overmoyer, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice with inflammatory breast cancer, or IBC.
So I have a 40-year-old premenopausal woman who is a lawyer and developed sort of a classic presentation, which is she basically was on vacation and noticed that her bathing suit top was not fitting appropriately. One of the breasts was becoming larger than the other. It was associated with some discomfort, but not enough to take medication. And then when she returned home from vacation, she really noticed that the nipple was starting to invert, that the breast was significantly larger than the contralateral breast, the skin was getting thickened, slight erythema. And I think the one thing that I want to point out is this whole issue of erythema. Because she was aware of the changes in her breast, she really sought a consultation quite early. And also probably because she was, you know, understanding sort of the whole health process, she saw her PCP, who evaluated her. And again, because of the understanding of the disease from the PCP, sent her for imaging and a surgical consultation right away. And didn't do what has been done in the past, which is antibiotics, could this be mastitis? And that, of course, delays things out to 6 months. So what's very important, I think, about the diagnosis of IBC is, number one, the signs and symptoms come on so quickly. And we've looked at our data and have found on an average, it actually presents within 2 months. The diagnosis is made within 2 months of the onset of signs and symptoms in our epidemiology studies here. And this concept of how much erythema do you need? Because what we're finding is that we see breast enlargement, we see skin edema, we see extensive nodal involvement, subpectoral, axillary, subclavicular, but we don't see a lot of erythema. We may see just a faint pinkness, just a pinkness maybe in 25% of the breast, 10% of the breast, because the patients, I think, are being seen faster. So one of the things that we're talking about as a group, an international group, is, you know, how do we change the criteria for the diagnosis? You know, because I think people are being seen much earlier in the disease course. This isn't Hagenson's inflammatory breast cancer anymore.
So what kind of biopsy did this lady have and what was seen?
So she actually also had a skin biopsy as well as a core biopsy in the breast. And the skin biopsy actually was negative, which is what we see about 25% of the time. So that didn't change anything. But the core biopsy actually showed ER/PR negative, HER2 positive disease. And that's actually quite common, more common in IBC than non-IBC. In some studies, it's up to 30-40% of inflammatory breast cancers are HER2 positive. Most often ER/PR negative, HER2 positive. And those patients really have exquisitely sensitive disease to HER2-targeted therapies. So we have a study here where patients have a research biopsy in the breast, and then they have a load of pertuzumab and trastuzumab, and then a week later, they get another research biopsy and start trastuzumab and paclitaxel weekly. What we're trying to examine is minimizing chemotherapy administration in this patient population because, by definition, you know, IBC is very chemo-resistant. And so it's unclear how much chemotherapy you need in the HER2-positive patient population and maximizing the HER2-directed therapies. And what we have seen clinically is that these patients have a dramatic disease response just with pertuzumab and trastuzumab. Their first dose administration, they feel better already, as did this patient. Reduction in the size of the breast, reduction in the size of the axillary adenopathy. And then she goes on to continue with weekly paclitaxel and trastuzumab with pertuzumab every 3 weeks to complete a 16-week course and then have surgery. And our primary endpoint of the study is actually path CR rate. And we've actually, it was a two-stage design. We've actually gone through our first stage already in 7 patients. So we're already in our second stage. And we're opening it up to other institutions.
Although, I mean, just with ER/PR negative, HER2 positive disease, you expect quite a high path CR rate. You think it would be even higher with inflammatory?
I don't know whether it's going to be higher, technically speaking, or at least when you look at the literature, their outcome seems to be more favorable in that patient population. But what I would like to see is actually minimizing toxicity, because again, you know, with the quote standard preoperative HER2 positive treatment of pertuzumab, trastuzumab, docetaxel, and carboplatin, hospitalizations are significant. The toxicity is really great, and I'm just not sure whether people need that much chemotherapy.
I'm really fascinated that you start out with this run-in period with just the two antibodies, because I always thought that the arm of the Neosphere study that had that in it, the neoadjuvant HER2 study, they had 25-30% path CRs. And of course, people give chemo because it's higher, but there was always this thought, well, what's the biology of what's going on? What do we know nowadays about the biology of inflammatory breast cancer and HER2-positive inflammatory breast cancer in particular?
Oh boy, that's a good question. And hopefully this study will enlighten us a little bit more. In terms of the biology, we know that they overexpress Ecadherin, making them much more cohesive. We know that they are exquisitely sensitive to HER2-directed therapy, that HER2-positive disease isn't an independent adverse prognostic indicator in that particular patient population. In terms of whether it acts differently, in terms of the PI3 kinase mutations, are they more common? Are they less common? We don't have that information in IBC. We're actually just starting to look for, let's say, a unique gene signature, which we have not consistently been able to find in IBC. We're looking at stroma because we think actually that there's very little, well, at least some feel that there's very little difference in the exact nature of the breast cancer in IBC. It really has to do with the microenvironment that may be different. But we don't know a lot about this disease. And unfortunately, we are really working on trying to get our tissue together in terms of an international group to see whether anything consistently comes out. So I don't have a great answer for your question right now. We'll be looking at mechanisms of HER2-directed therapy resistance, and we're going to be looking at genomics in terms of PAM50 analysis, et cetera, so that we might be able to get some more information out from this study.
So you know that I've got to ask you about immune issues and inflammatory breast cancer, because it just seems like little pockets of tumors are popping up every day. I was talking to your colleague, Charlie Fuchs, about the MSI-high colon cancer, where they're seeing responses to PD-1 antibodies. What about inflammatory breast cancer?
Right. So we feel that probably PD-1 antibodies should be very effective in inflammatory breast cancer, not necessarily by clinical responses, but just by understanding the biology. There isn't really a lymphocytic infiltrate in this disease. There are some good work being done on monocytes and macrophages, trying to see whether that actually gives some type of an immune response or immune-mediated disease progress in IBC. But we don't understand a lot of it. Let me put it that way.
What about triple-negative inflammatory breast cancer and ER-positive, HER2-negative inflammatory breast cancer? What do we know about the outcomes and response to therapy, and how do you treat those patients?
Yeah. So with triple-negative IBC, again, more common, triple-negative disease is more common in IBC than non-IBC. Some retrospective studies show 40 to 50% of IBC is actually triple-negative. Their outcomes are actually very poor. We evaluated our studies and found a disease-free survival. So these are patients who present with stage 3 triple-negative disease. Disease-free survival is actually 19 months. So they relapse extremely quickly. Nellie Polyak, one of our basic scientists, has done a lot of work looking at the JAK2 STAT3 pathway and found that actually it is really upregulated or very active in inflammatory breast cancer, all subtypes, including those, quote, luminal A's, the ERPR-positive HER2-negatives. So it seemed to be a very active pathway in the survival mechanism for IBC, but definitely close to 100% of our triple-negative IBCs have this overexpressed activated STAT3 mechanism. So we are actually starting a phase 2 study, pre-op study, using ruxolitinib, the JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor, with paclitaxel followed by Dostens AC for preoperative therapy of triple-negative IBC, trying to look at that JAK-STAT pathway and trying to see whether that's a good target for triple-negative disease, because we haven't been able to find a good target for triple-negative IBC.
What about metastatic inflammatory breast cancer? Any thought about using JAK inhibitors there?
Yeah, so we had a phase 1 trial here that just closed with ruxolitinib and paclitaxel for metastatic disease. We actually enrolled several IBC patients in that trial. Just anecdotally, I have one patient who is still on study. The study was interesting. You could take ruxolitinib and paclitaxel to disease response, and then you can drop the paclitaxel and continue on single-agent ruxolitinib. Each cycle is 3 weeks. She is now on 21 cycles. It will be a year in October that she has been on single-agent ruxolitinib with metastatic triple-negative IBC, no evidence of disease. So there are some subtypes that really respond to that particular target.
That's interesting. In terms of tolerability, what we've heard about in myelofibrosis, et cetera, mainly is about anemia, not too much quality of life issues. Is that what you see with breast cancer?
Yes, exactly. And that's why we feel that it was very safe to use with paclitaxel, because you really don't have this cross-reacting toxicities between the two. So it's really thrombocytopenia and anemia. We've had some episodes of peripheral edema, which you can see with ruxolitinib. That's been quite rare, but when it happens, it can be significant. It could interfere with actually continuing the dose of drug.
I'm sure you had discussions with your patient about what to expect from the future. How do you assess a prognosis in a patient like this, and how does it vary based on response to therapy?
So the problem that we have with IBC is that historically, we have included inflammatory breast cancer patients into our locally advanced non-inflammatory breast cancer patients. So, for example, in Neosphere, each of the arms contained 4 or 5 inflammatory breast cancer patients. So how do I say what the outcome will be on 5 patients who were treated with chemotherapy, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab? So what I try to counsel my patients are, we know that, for example, in HER2-positive disease, their outcome is more favorable, and that historically we've seen a more favorable outcome among the IBC population as a whole, but that it's very difficult for me to actually give them numbers, because even when we look at the historical data, it's very muddied.
So what about the possibility of cure, of not having the disease come back? Can you come up with a number there?
Yeah. So I think that we can say that they have, if they have a good path CR rate, they have a good 50 to 60% chance of cure overall. I think that that's probably an underestimate given certain patient populations and the newer therapies nowadays. This is really a moving target, so it's very hard to say.
Now, this lady, has she gone to surgery yet?
No, not yet.
But she's had a clinical response?
Wonderful response. She's halfway through her therapy now.
And does she have evidence of disease on physical exam?
She has some thickening of the breast parenchyma, no discrete mass, very mild skin thickening. The nipple is starting to become less inverted, and there's resolution of all erythema and resolution of all peripheral adenopathy.
You know, it's interesting. I guess they're only on the double antibody for, what, a week?
They're on the double antibody for a week, but that's sort of the time that we check our biopsies.
Yeah, no, but I guess I'm trying to remember, are there any other neoadjuvant studies other than the Neosphere study where they've used just the two antibodies and no chemo?
Yeah, there's a study from the TBCRC, and I believe it's out of Michigan as the primary site, that is looking at the double antibody for preoperative therapy.
But no data yet.
I believe that the data just showed that it was tolerable and something that's going to be expanded to other sites, to larger numbers.
In addition to the question of clinical response or what happens translationally, I'd be fascinated to find out what happens in terms of symptoms, because it's kind of hard to figure out tolerability issues with pertuzumab, because, you know, generally you're given chemotherapy, you might be given docetaxel. You know, I hear about diarrhea, hear about maybe skin changes, but again, it's always tricky because you got all these other drugs on board. I don't know if a week's a long enough time, but have you had patients who got diarrhea, for example?
Yes, diarrhea can happen after the first treatment, to the point where actually we routinely give a dose of Lamotil with their loading dose in the office, so that they can at least get home.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
But the other thing is, you are absolutely right. And so we have a lot of experience with weekly paclitaxel and trastuzumab. And so what we're seeing is what the addition of pertuzumab does to that. And what we see is more of a rash, the nodular rash on the fingers and the erythematous rash on the arms, more acneiform rash on the back. Diarrhea can be really problematic, but otherwise, it's really well tolerated.
So it sounds like there are not too many patients with IBC who are ER positive, HER2 negative. But in those patients, how do you manage them? And have any of those patients ever had Oncotype done?
None of them have had Oncotypes done, to my knowledge.
That'd be interesting.
It would be very interesting.
You ought to send a couple of those off. How often do you see a patient like that to start with?
Well, they say it's some of the studies, again, 20-40% are still ERPR positive, HER2 negative. So it's not an unknown patient population. We're starting a trial looking actually at eribulin, because eribulin in some preclinical data, some mouse models, targets angiogenesis, can change vascular flow and change EMT-directed genes. So our study is actually trying to mimic that, trying to use eribulin in place of paclitaxel, followed by dose-dense AC, using, again, the dual biopsies to look at changes in angiogenesis genes, changes in EMT genes, and also DCE MRI blood flow, because IBC is very angiogenic, more so than non-IBC. So we're trying to see whether this drug really targets angiogenesis. So that's how we treat those particular patients who have ER-positive disease, HER2-negative disease. But I really am very keen on seeing what the Oncotype is, what the genomic sort of difference would be in the ER-positive, HER2-negative patient population.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can get it paid for, but you maybe ought to just send a couple of them off. I mean, I'm going to put my money that they've got a lot of high scores.
Yes, and the question is how high? Because one thing that you and I talked about, I think the last time we Skyped, was whether the level of Oncotype recurrence score actually predicts the need to increase chemotherapy administration,
right,
you know,
right,
regardless of anatomy.
Right.
And so I've always been fascinated with that because I don't think we have good data to say yay or nay. And I think that that would be something to really explore.
The other study you talked about with the eribulin is interesting in the same way about the pertuzumab, and that usually when eribulin is given, people have already had a lot of other treatment. You're giving it to people who have not had anything.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Again, I'd be really fascinated. I don't know if you have any patients yet in terms of tolerability when you start out in an untreated patient getting eribulin.
Right. So it hasn't opened yet. It's actually going through IRB now. So I can't say that. I can tell you that we also have a first-line, second-line eribulin study. That's for metastatic disease.
Right.
I've treated a lot of patients with first-line eribulin, and it's tolerated actually very well. I think my major issues in terms of tolerability, as others, has to do with neuropathy, that after X number of cycles, the neuropathy can be pretty severe. You can work around the neutropenia using Neupogen, Neulasta, but the neuropathy can be quite problematic. Otherwise, it's tolerated quite well.
What about alopecia?
Alopecia, unfortunately, in my experience, does occur more so than I'd like to say, but it is a little more favorable than paclitaxel in our experience. So you really have a delayed alopecia. They really need to be on therapy for quite some time before you see it. But I know that the earlier reports really stated very minimal alopecia, minimal incidence of alopecia. I'm not sure we're really seeing that.
So any observations in terms of activity of eribulin in these metastatic studies?
Well, I know that this particular study is looking at two cohorts, the triple negatives and the ER positives. Outside of a clinical trial, just anecdotally, because I treat a lot of people, my sense is that eribulin actually works better in ER positive disease than ER negative disease. I've just not been as enthusiastic with it. It's very similar. Again, this is totally anecdotal, but gemcitabine, capecitabine, eribulin seem to be the drugs that I use for ER-positive disease. Those are the subtypes that seem to respond to those chemotherapies. I've just not had as much luck or as long of a duration of response when I use it in ER-negative disease. But we'll get the data from this particular trial.
Although, I guess the eribulin versus capecitabine trials look like it showed better activity, at least compared to capecitabine in triple negative disease.
I know. I can't, you know, again, my experience is absolutely not based on the data. It just has to do with what I see.
What tends to be, in the metastatic setting, your next therapy in a patient's already had anthracycline taxane?
If they're ER positive, I do go to capecitabine. After that, gemcitabine. If they are triple negatives, to be frank with you, I try to use the platinum agents earlier. So I actually try to use the platinum agents even before the taxanes. I have been, of course, thrilled with anthracyclines in triple negative disease. I think that those drugs really work, but I have a tendency to use the platinums, and actually the old CMF works well in our triple negatives with metastatic disease early on.
Interesting. Just to finish out on IBC, any comments on recent research? I see you have a paper looking at brain mets with IBC. Another paper looks really interesting on patterns of failure and the case for aggressive local regional management.
Yeah, so thank you for bringing up the CNS paper, because you had alluded to something along that earlier in our conversation. That's a fascinating paper because it actually is one of the largest, if not the largest, study looking at patients who present with metastatic disease, which can happen up to 25% of the time, versus those patients who don't. And what the study really shows is that those patients who present with metastatic disease have a greater incidence of developing brain metastases earlier than those patients who, let's say, relapse, even though they have presented with non-metastatic disease. And so what we are looking at in terms of that, I mean, that's a retrospective study, but what it actually allows us to discuss is whether we should screen our patients who present with metastatic disease, IBC, with MRIs. And how that has at least changed my practice is, getting back to the second paper, is patients who have targetable disease, HER2-positive disease, ER-positive disease, they have a great response, especially to HER2-directed therapies, but the local regional control is still problematic. And they actually will live long enough to have a problem, according to that paper, a local regional problem, unless we aggressively manage their local regional disease. Prior to sending them to surgery, I will get an MRI of their brain because of that higher incidence of developing brain mets if they have metastatic IBC.
So I was going to ask you how you generally approach the patient who presents with metastatic disease with IBC, particularly from the point of view of local therapy. What do you do?
Because their morbidity most often is associated with their local disease, we do aggressively treat that. So if they have ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, for example, they get chemotherapy. If they have HER2-positive disease, of course, they get HER2-directed therapies plus chemotherapy. We do use the pertuzumab, trastuzumab, weekly paclitaxel approach in that setting. If they have an excellent systemic response to their metastatic disease and an excellent local regional response, we actually involve the radiation oncologist and the surgical oncologist so that we work as a team to say, when is the optimal time to pursue local regional disease control? But we really feel that if this is a person who's responded so well and can be actually weaned off of chemotherapy and maintained on HER2-directed therapy, those are the people who can go for surgery and radiation. Because we have so many HER2-directed therapies down the line for that patient population that it really behooves us to sort of focus on local regional up front, and then we can deal with the systemic disease out back. The triple negatives are tough because if they present with metastatic disease, our experience is that they relapse so quickly that local regional control may not necessarily be in their best interest.
But just to clarify, so you're saying if you've got a patient with, say, ER-positive, HER2-negative IBC, mm-hmm. let's say they have a great clinical response to systemic therapy, let's say a clinical CR, mm-hmm. you still are going to send them to surgery?
We will have that conversation. And it's based on these retrospective analyses, two of which were published, one through MD Anderson, one through us, which really show that especially in the patients who have this targetable disease, ER-positive, HER2-negative, or HER2-positive disease, if we do not address their local regional disease control, they will progress local regionally prior to progressing systemically. And it is very difficult to get their local regional disease under control, and that really is a lot of morbidity. The SEER data suggests that those patients who have surgery with metastatic IBC have a 50% improvement in overall survival, but that's SEER data. We're not saying that these patients will live longer. It's really a palliation.
As long as we're bringing that up, what's your position on outside of IBC, just metastatic breast cancer in general, in terms of doing surgery or local therapy on the primary? It's been very controversial. We're starting to see some data on that. Are you doing it?
So it is really controversial. And even within our own institution, we have people on both sides of the fence. it would be great to get some more prospective data to help with that. Some recent prospective data actually does not support what the retrospective population data has shown, which is that it improves overall survival. So it may not be of benefit. The interesting thing to me is that it may not allow the patients to live longer, but my experience is that treating the local regional disease is much more difficult than treating the systemic disease, that somehow we have one shot at it. So after we get a very good local regional disease response, once it starts growing in the breast, I never feel like I can get a handle on that particular disease. I can control the hepatic disease, I can control the bone disease, the pulmonary disease, but the breast disease has a tendency to just continue to grow. So I wind up going through multiple regimens to control local regional disease, when if I could just remove it, I would be in a better situation. So my personal bias is that in certain circumstances, palliation with local regional control is still a viable option in patients who have metastatic disease.
Yeah, I can remember Seema Khan doing a discussion on this not too long ago and clarifying that this whole argument is not about people at risk for local control, because they're clearly, they need local therapy. But you're saying that just in general, the scenario can be difficult to control, even if it doesn't look like it's going to be difficult. I'm kind of curious, you said you see 2 to 4 new IBC patients a month. How often do you have patients with out of control chest wall disease or, you know, local disease?
So not up front, clearly, not when they first present, but out back, absolutely. And I think the difficulty is with IBC is when you talk about out of control chest wall disease, you really do talk about patients who have been able to have a mastectomy and then they have a chest wall recurrence and extension to the contralateral breast. And I see that a lot. How much? I think it's hard for me to say. In my senses, it's probably as common as those patients who have metastatic disease, trying to control chest wall disease. I think that that's been a focus of research from the Inflammatory Breast Cancer Research Foundation for funding for research for that. And I think that there are some targeted therapies that may be beneficial that need to be pursued. But that's a real subtype of disease that needs to be addressed.
Any sort of clinical pearls you have about managing out-of-control local disease, particularly any local modalities you found helpful?
I used to use a topical thrombin for those patients, you know, who had a lot of bleeding. I'm now in the process of pursuing an SRS kind of approach to the nodules. If there's a specific it's interesting because everyone is completely different. Every cancer is completely different. But those cancers that develop exophytic nodules may be treated with sort of very localized radiotherapy. In terms of the symptoms, the pruritus that's often just horrible, pregabalin works, gabapentin works. And to be frank with you, in terms of the pain that's associated with chest wall disease, methadone. That is the best drug, better than narcotics.
Really?
It really is a fabulous drug when it comes to chest wall pain.
I mean, do you find methadone helpful for bone pain and other kinds of pain?
You know, I have used it in other kinds of pain, but I find I have a much lower threshold to use it for chest wall pain. Pain that's associated with leptomeningeal disease, methadone works well with that.
So let's talk about your 60-year-old lady.
She was diagnosed with a 1.8 centimeter invasive ductal carcinoma, ER pause, PR neg, HER2 neg, had breast conserving surgery, and 0 of 1 sentinel lymph nodes were involved, so node negative. Appropriately sent off, in my opinion, an Oncotype DX recurrence score, which was high, 35. So she then received 4 cycles of adjuvant, docetaxel, and cyclophosphamide, and began letrozole. So she was on letrozole for about, I don't know, several months, and I guess was changed to tamoxifen because of myalgias associated with that.
Before you continue on, I'm always curious about your clinical pearls because you have so many great ones. Anything exciting that you do in your practice with myalgias and arthralgias with AIs?
I'm trying them all. You know, some of the data that was presented suggests that fish oil, omega-3s, and vitamin D help. Glucosamine, anecdotally, I think really works. It either works or it doesn't work, but when it works, it's beautiful. And then exercise. And again, anecdotally, water aerobics is really fantastic when it comes to the myalgias and arthralgias with AIs. So those are the things that I really try to use. outside of prescription medications.
Glucosamine?
Yeah, glucosamine is fabulous. It's
but
the first thing I try.
That's the cartilage stuff? What
yeah.
is that?
Yeah, glucosamine chondroitin sulfate.
And it works?
Yep. At least we have one study in arthritis, so it's not so outside the norm. But in terms of the AI, myalgias and arthralgias, yes. It's the first thing I try.
Any tolerability issues?
Glucosamine's tolerated beautifully unless you're allergic to sulfa.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. How long does it take to see a benefit?
Oh, within a week?
Really?
Yeah. It's amazing.
And what fraction of patients respond in your own experience?
Probably about a third.
Hmm. That's a good yeah. one. I haven't heard that. I knew if I asked you something, I was going to hear something I never heard before. Okay, so she gets switched to the tamoxifen, then what?
And then about 2 years later, she developed ipsilateral supraclavicular adenopathy and just developed extensive adenopathy, axillary, subpectoral, supraclavicular, cervical, posterior cervical, and bone metastases. So they biopsied it. It was still ER pos, PR neg, HER2 neg. And was started briefly by her primary oncologist on capecitabine. And again, this, of course, goes against my anecdotal experience because she didn't respond to capecitabine, actually progressed within about 4 months, and then came to us and was placed on our second-line eribulin trial. And so she received eribulin for about 5 months.
What was it that got the referring doc and you to use chemo as opposed to more hormones?
Probably the fact that she progressed on endocrine therapy within about 2 years, and this was significant adenopathy. I mean, this was causing difficulty swallowing, significant amount of pain, and she never tolerated pain medication, so it was very hard to get her quality of life up to par. So we really thought if we could cytoreduce it, the bulk of disease, with chemotherapy, we could then put her on endocrine therapy to sort of keep things at bay. And that was really the rationale.
So that brings us up to last December. What was her condition at that point?
Pretty poor. She actually was hospitalized briefly during that time because of pain, elevated liver enzymes, pain in terms of the lymph node involvement, abdominal pain, anemia. Her performance status was, I would say, 2. She, however, was such a strong person that she continued to work and go to school, and so she was very highly motivated. The thought was, you know, we've seen some of the studies suggest maybe a 30% response rate with abemaciclib in patients who were treated as she was and who had soft tissue involvement, you know, nodal involvement. So she really fit the phenotype of a person who should respond to single agent abemaciclib.
And I guess, you know, just thinking about the whole case, she's not your typical ER positive HER2 negative. In the beginning, with the fact that she had this recurrence score of 35, she had this early recurrence. I mean, biologically, it's just not a typical ER positive case.
She really isn't. It's not a typical ER positive case, but it fit the criteria for this study based on prior studies. So we really thought that this would be a good drug for her. Plus, she really didn't tolerate a lot of therapy, required a lot of transfusions on eribulin, which was outside the norm. And again, pain control was really an issue, and she really focused on quality of life. We felt that that would be a good drug for her. And in fact, she really clinically improved. I don't think it was just placebo effect. I really think it was the drug. Her pain level reduced, the lymph nodes reduced in size as well as in texture. Even her primary oncologist felt that she was responding nicely. She had a pleural effusion. She had a pleurex catheter placed, and that was decreasing in volume. So she did well for several months. They were critical months for her because they were during the holidays. So we felt that we did offer her something that benefited her. It may be it was just too little too late.
So then she had disease progression.
She did. She had disease progression and then actually developed a pericardial effusion and decided to forego further therapy.
What a shame.
It really is. It really is.
But getting back to the abemaciclib, when she was responding, what was going on in terms of tolerability? I know that we're going to talk about palbo. Counts have been a problem. Are counts a problem with abemaciclib? And how are her counts with all this prior therapy?
Yeah, actually, counts are a problem with abemaciclib, but we actually have several studies with palbociclib, and my experience is it's not as significant, even though it's given daily without a break. So she actually tolerated it very well, extremely well. We didn't even need to significantly dose reduce her, which often we do. Within the first month or two, we routinely have to dose reduce these patients, maybe by one dose level.
Because of what? Counts?
Counts.
What about GI issues? I'm hearing stuff about that.
Yeah, exactly. She actually did not have significant GI issues. The second patient who I presented to you actually did. But she actually tolerated it remarkably well, to the point where we wished we could keep her on the drug because she had slow progression, but she tolerated the drug so well that if it was off of a clinical trial, I would have kept her on this particular drug.
Seems like it would have been interesting at the point she progressed to add it back in a hormone.
Yes. Yeah, with the drug. Absolutely.
And
great thought.
Certainly, obviously, palbo has been used with hormones. But what do we know about abemaciclib in terms of activity with and without hormone therapy?
I can quote you the 30% response rate of abemaciclib in this patient population, ER-positive, prior chemotherapy, especially taxanes, that, again, it has about a 30% response rate as a single agent. In terms of palbo as a single agent, I can't recall any. I never quote single agent data for palbo.
What about in combination with hormones?
Right, but in combination with hormones, with letrozole, you know, it doubles the progression-free survival with upfront therapy. So from something like a 10-month progression-free survival to a 20-month progression-free survival. So it's been very, very active in frontline AI administration with palbociclib. And then Paloma 3, just presented, shows that it's also very active when given with fulvestrant in patients who have progressed after endocrine therapy. And so that's very exciting. So it seems as though it really enhances the efficacy of endocrine therapy. It should also enhance therapies with triple negative disease. And so we're also evaluating it in combination with chemotherapy and triple negative disease.
That's interesting. What do we know about abemaciclib with hormone therapy?
So we have a study using abemaciclib and anastrozole. And I have a patient, a 70-year-old patient, who presented with locally advanced disease as well as involvement in the ovaries and bone. I was concerned when she presented, actually, that she had two malignancies. I wasn't convinced that she didn't have ovarian cancer and breast cancer. And so she actually went to a TAHBSO for diagnostic purposes / therapeutic purposes. And that, in fact, was metastatic breast cancer, which was ER/PR positive, HER2 negative. And she was placed on our clinical trial with abemaciclib and anastrozole. She has been on therapy now for 1 year. She had a difficult time with diarrhea. And we had to hold her therapy up front initially during the first 3 to 4 months, significantly hold therapy and then dose reduce. But she is, for the last, I would say, 9-10 months, has been functioning beautifully. She's completely asymptomatic, has no diarrhea, no problem in terms of neutrophil counts, and she's had a great response. She's had a PR with her disease in lungs and breast.
I'm just kind of curious with the diarrhea, did you hold both drugs or just the abemaciclib?
And just the abemaciclib.
Right. And of course, I mean, she's had a great response, but we don't know what this might have happened with just the anastrozole alone.
Exactly.
So where are things heading with this drug, abemaciclib, knowing that palbo's out there as another option, but without the monotherapy? Is it going to be developed more as monotherapy or more combination?
Probably combination.
That's what I've heard. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess the other question I want to ask you is right now, I mean, body's kind of reconsidering their algorithms in ER-positive disease. And, of course, the most common situation that people ask about is the patient who relapses on an adjuvant hormone therapy, particularly in AI. How do you evaluate those patients? Is everybody getting palbo nowadays, or some people just get hormones?
If they are newly relapsed or, you know, first or second line recurrence that we're looking at in terms of therapy, I always try to give them palbociclib. So there's their first recurrence or their first exposure, let's say, to endocrine therapy. They may have had chemotherapy and now they're on endocrine therapy. I always try to add the palbo, so I'll combine that with the AI. If they've had an AI, then I will go with fulvestrant and add palbo. I haven't had a lot of pushback from insurance companies thus far thanks to Paloma 3. So I think that that's definitely the way to go. I think in those patients who actually relapse on an AI adjuvantly, fulvestrant and palbociclib would be the off-study treatment of choice.
What about the patient who presents with metastatic ER-positive, HER2-negative disease?
If they are not in crisis and I don't need to give them chemotherapy and we're not talking about a clinical trial, off a clinical trial, letrozole and palbociclib is my first line.
Where is everolimus fitting in for you nowadays?
I've had a lot of experience with everolimus way back when we were first evaluating it, and I'm pleased and surprised that it's come so far. I wasn't so encouraged decades ago. So since everolimus is approved with exemestane second-line therapy, I put it into the, let's go with an AI and palbociclib, and then you could try exemestane and everolimus. If you were doing well, you could do fulvestrant and palbociclib and then do exemestane and everolimus. I have a tendency to use the everolimus out back. I know I've talked to Joyce O'Shaughnessy about her experience with everolimus, which is much more favorable than my experience. I've had a difficult time with that drug in terms of mucositis and fatigue. I have had to dose reduce every single time I've used it, and I've had a difficult time keeping patients on the drug to the point where I may be able to get up to, I think my maximum was 6 months, and then I had to stop it and just keep them on exemestane.
You had a couple of cases you pulled. I'm really curious about the paclitaxel trastuzumab adjuvant trial. As I mentioned, I spoke with Sarah Tolaney on this series. Can you talk about these two ladies who got treated with that regimen?
Both were on Sarah's trial. The first one was a 50-year-old. She was perimenopausal, had a mammographically detected 0.6 centimeters invasive ductal carcinoma, grade 2, but had perineural invasion, ERPR positive, HER2 positive, node negative, had breast-conserving surgery, and then was placed on the study. And the rationale for her, when she saw an outside oncologist, the outside oncologist felt that she was young, but was debating between just endocrine therapy for her because she was ER-positive, PR-positive, or giving her ACTH or TCH, which was, in our opinion, a little aggressive for a T1BN0 HER2-positive disease. So for her, we really felt that the weekly paclitaxel followed by trastuzumab was very beneficial, primarily because she got the trastuzumab and enabled her to continue on trastuzumab and add the endocrine therapy, which would help with her hormone receptor positive disease. So she, to me, fits that trial perfectly, trying to avoid overtreatment, but also we know the benefit of trastuzumab in HER2 positive disease adjuvantly. So we really wanted to give that to her as a young woman. The second patient is an older woman, 72 years old, but otherwise very healthy, very active, had multifocal disease. So she had a 1.7 centimeter foci, a 1.5 centimeter focus, grade 3, extensive LVI, but node negative, ER positive, PR negative, HER2 positive. So she was someone who really had more aggressive disease, but not node positive. I think she would have made criteria, I believe, for the BCIRG study, but she has significant aggressive tumor to warrant some type of chemotherapy, definitely with HER2-directed therapy. But again, she's 72, so I don't really want to give her TCH. I don't really want to give her ACTH, but I want to give her trastuzumab and a little bit of chemo. And so she was perfect also for the study, I feel. She had a tolerable regimen of paclitaxel with trastuzumab, followed by the trastuzumab, and then began her AI. And so she was, again, perfect for this study. Not too much chemotherapy, but definitely adding the trastuzumab so that she could have the benefit.
So, of course, your study only had one arm. There were very, very few recurrences, which was gratifying. I'm curious how much TCH you use nowadays.
Right. Good question. I actually have a lot of experience with the TCH, so I feel very comfortable in giving that. I find it actually less cardiotoxic than the ACTH, so it is actually my regimen of choice adjuvantly for those patients who are node positive. I actually feel very comfortable with the TH regimen, with the paclitaxel and trastuzumab regimen, especially if they're node negative. if we start getting into larger tumor size, so, T2N0, so stage 2 disease, maybe those patients would benefit from more chemotherapy and they would get the docetaxel carboplatin and trastuzumab regimen. But really, the stage 1, I feel very comfortable with the TH. I don't think that these patients need so much chemotherapy. I think they really benefit from the trastuzumab. We're part of course, Sarah's study, the ATTEMPT trial, which compares TH, paclitaxel and trastuzumab, to T-DM1 adjuvantly in those patients who have stage 1 disease. So I think that that's going to be very helpful. You're right. There is no comparator to that in terms of the ACTH and TCH, but at least in our low-risk patient population, we might be moving forward in things that are less toxic, but still beneficial. So I personally use a lot of TH because we see a lot of these smaller HER2-positive tumors.